people who traded everywhere.
Angela says no matter what the president does, Denali will always be Denali. I'm Rhonda McBride.
New research suggests that coyotes are more abundant in areas where hunting them is allowed. Caroline Long for the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
Coyotes are native to the southwestern United States, but they have expanded their range rapidly in the last century.
Now they're found basically throughout all of North America. Our main goal was to figure out what are the environmental and human-led factors driving this expansion.
Austin Green is an associate instructor at the University of Utah. He analyzed data from Snapshot USA, a network of camera traps across the United States. Research found that in Utah, Wyoming, Montana, and Nevada, where hunting and trapping coyotes is barely regulated, coyotes are more abundant.
There was no evidence across our model or across other investigations that unregulated coyote hunting is a legitimate population control measure.
I'm Caroline Long.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 30th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Isabel Charlet, Suzanne Potter, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Most Americans dislike Trump, but like a few of his policies. Trump withdraws the United States from the Paris Accord and the World Health Organization. And Trump's budget cuts cause wide international harm. First, some poll results on Trump and his policies. Two major polls reaffirm the divisions in our society over Donald Trump and his initial policy pronouncements. The New York Times Ipsos poll offers the following findings. First, Donald Trump does not have a popular mandate to do whatever he wishes. His popularity is just under 50%, like the popular vote last November. Next, overwhelmingly, Americans believe the political system is broken, differing mainly over how long it has been broken. 55% somewhat or strongly support mass deportations of people who have arrived illegally, but the poll shows substantial support for DACA children and for birthright citizenship. There is also support for the belief that immigrants benefit U.S. society, though the number is down from previous polls. Next, there is strong support for an America First foreign policy, particularly in the wake of the Ukraine war and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And last, belief that government is corrupt and the wealthy unfairly benefit is widespread. A CBS poll conducted in mid-January supports the finding that most people are unhappy with the state of the union, especially the economy. yet by 60-40%, Americans are optimistic about the next 4 years. However, they are withholding judgment of Trump until they see what he does. And by 57-42%, they believe democracy and the rule of law are not secure. Their priorities are crime, inflation, and the economy, not climate change or race and diversity. Interestingly, people polled oppose high tariffs because of their likely effect on prices, believe that Trump's economic policies will mainly favor the wealthy, and don't want the United States to buy Greenland. Takeaways from these polls? First, Americans, as usual, have the attitude of show me. They're giving Trump support as he gets started, but it's not a free pass to do whatever he likes. Americans' optimism is shaded as never before. If Trump performs as he did the first time around, anticipate a political rebellion. Trump withdraws the United States from the Paris Accord and the World Health Organization. As promised, Donald Trump again removed the United States from the Paris Accord on climate change and from the World Health Organization as well. But a group of philanthropists led by Michael Bloomberg announced that it will cover U.S. financial obligations to the UN climate framework. An AP poll shows that only 21% of Americans support withdrawal from the Paris Accord, with 52% opposed. By the way, the next UN climate change conference, called COP30, will be held in the Amazon region, and the conference president will be a career Brazilian diplomat, Andre Aranha Correio de Lago, who is an environmental secretary in Brazil's foreign ministry and a longtime fighter against climate change. Trump's budget cuts cause wide international harm. In a move consistent with his early shock and awe strategy, Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced that virtually all foreign aid, the $60 billion budget for humanitarian, development, and military assistance, would be suspended pending a review. Initially, the only exceptions to the suspension were military aid to Israel and Egypt and emergency humanitarian assistance. Outrage followed, and now life-saving assistance is said to be allowed. No one is certain what that means. Will it, for example, end USAID to protect against AIDS, a program started under George W. Bush that is credited with saving more than 25 million lives worldwide? That program is now frozen. Life-saving assistance will not include money for abortions, family planning, or gender diversity programs. Budget cuts will also affect USAID programs and non-governmental organizations, in particular those that promote diversity, equity, inclusion, LGBTQ rights, anti-poverty programs, disaster relief, and probably human rights in general. The cuts will also affect USAID to national ministries of health under the World Health Organization. Vaccine programs abroad may also be affected, especially if RFK Jr. is confirmed as health secretary. Also affected will be USAID to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos to find and clear unexploded ordnance, bombs, mines, and ammunition that the U.S. used during the Vietnam War, a program that has spent around $750 million so far. Responding to the budget cuts, two Democrats in Congress said, quote, "As leaders of the House and Senate committees on appropriations, we write with extreme alarm about the administration's efforts to undermine Congress's power of the purse, threaten our national security, and deny resources for states, localities, American families, and businesses." On the military front, Trump, in the words of the New York Times, quote, "fired the first woman to ever lead a military service branch," that was Admiral Linda Fagan, "signed an order to send 1,500 active duty U.S. troops to the border," in what one officer called a photo op, and said he was reinstating, with back pay, former service members who had refused to take COVID vaccinations, a breach of military health rules. General Mark Milley, Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman under Biden and once a Trump appointee, is now accused of disloyalty. Portraits of him at the Pentagon have been taken down, his security detail has been removed, and Pete Hegseth, now Defense Secretary, promises to investigate Milley despite his having been pardoned by Biden. Milley, you'll recall, refused to support Trump's hope to use the military against black protesters in 2020 and has explicitly called Trump a fascist and national security threat. Pete Hegseth, who squeaked by in the confirmation vote, has added to the military's unease with comments about its current leaders. He has called Admiral Lisa Fanchetti, the chief of naval operations and the first woman to serve on the Joint Chiefs, quote, another inexperienced first. Actually, she has an exceptional combat record, as does another of the Joint Chiefs, General Charles Q. Brown Jr., whom Hegseth intends to fire for being too woke. Trump and Hegseth are also going after an array of service personnel who are, according to Trump's executive order, quote, afflicted with radical gender ideology to appease activists and have many mental and physical health conditions that are incompatible with active duty, unquote. That means soldiers with diagnoses that, quote, require substantial medication or medical treatment to bipolar and related disorders, eating disorders, suicidality, and prior psychiatric hospitalization, unquote. But the harshest targeting is directed at transgender soldiers who are said to be living in conflict, quote, with a soldier's commitment to an honorable, truthful, and disciplined lifestyle, even in one's personal life, unquote. For the moment, transgender soldiers are still on duty, but their dismissal from service seems certain. Otherwise, it was just an ordinary week in Washington. In other news, Romania's far-right presidential candidate leads in polls. On May 4, Romanians will try again to elect a president. As of this month, the far-right pro-Russian candidate, Calin Georgescu, leads in the polls over the pro-European Union coalition candidate and others. Whether or not Georgescu will be allowed to run remains to be seen. Last time he tried, the European Court invalidated the election, citing his extremist record. Romania is crucial to Ukraine's resistance to Russia, has the longest land border with Ukraine of any European Union country, and is a NATO member state. It has helped export millions of tons of Ukraine grain through its Black Sea port of Constanta, trained Ukrainian fighter pilots, and donated a Patriot air defense battery to Kyiv. Resistance in Latin America to Trump's deportations. Mexico and Colombia turned back U.S. military airlifts of migrant workers accused of crimes in the U.S. Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum remains firm, but Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, had to back down under Trump's withering attack. Initially, Petro had said, quote, I cannot make migrants stay in a country that does not want them, but if that country sends them back, it should be with dignity and respect for them and for our country, quote. Trump responded, as we might expect, with a 25% tariff on Colombian imports, rising to 50% in a week, banking and financial sanctions, a travel ban, and revocation of visas for all Colombian government officials. The threats worked. Colombia agreed to accept the flights. Petro said Colombia has overcome the impasse with the U.S., while Trump said America is respected again. That's Trump's diplomacy. Threaten friends and adversaries alike. The U.S. is Colombia's primary trade partner, but look for China to take advantage of this dispute. A third country, Guatemala, has accepted U.S. military flights carrying deportees. Marco Rubio holds his first meeting with his Chinese counterpart. Despite Trump's tariff threats, U.S. relations with China got off to a positive start. In his first meeting with China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi, Secretary of State Rubio subscribed to long-standing U.S. policy regarding Taiwan, saying the U.S. does not support Taiwan independence and hopes to see the issue resolved peacefully in a way acceptable to both sides of the Taiwan Strait. Wang Yi reiterated China's position that it, quote, will never allow Taiwan to be separated from the mainland. Wang demanded that the U.S. handle the matter with caution and not break its promises regarding accepting Taiwan as a part of China. Wang also used an unusual expression, urging Rubio to, quote, conduct himself responsibly, playing a constructive role in the future of the peoples of China and the U.S., as well as in maintaining global peace and stability. Wang Yi also said that a consensus had been reached between Presidents Xi and Trump in a telephone conversation, and that consensus was, quote, uphold the principles of mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and win-win cooperation, maintain communication, manage differences, expand cooperation, and promote the stable, healthy, and sustainable development of China-U.S. relations, finding a correct way for the two countries to get along in the new era, unquote. That language is ambiguous enough to get Trump's endorsement, but don't count on this honeymoon lasting. Next, Germany's AfD party in second place as elections loom. With a national snap election just a month away, it seems that Elon Musk's interventions on behalf of the far-right Alternative for Germany, AfD, are having an effect. The front-runner for Chancellor, Friedrich Merz of the Christian Democrats, is pushing for an immigration policy that mimics the AfD's, proposing tighter border controls and deportation of illegal migrants. The Christian Democrats are likely to win the election, and having the AfD's support on the crucial issue of immigration breaks a long-standing firewall between all the centrist and left parties on one side and the far right on the other. Mass demonstrations are taking place against the AfD and Merz's ideas. The firewall must not crumble, Chancellor Olaf Scholz, now leader of the third-place Social Democrats, has said. Trump's insistence grows on acquiring Greenland. Make no mistake, Donald Trump really means to pressure Denmark into selling Greenland to the United States. The Financial Times reports that Trump held a fiery call with Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen in January. The Financial Times, citing senior European officials, said Trump was, quote, aggressive and confrontational in blustering about his plans to take over the Danish territory. Trump has said publicly that he covets the mineral-rich territory for national security reasons. Frederiksen reiterated Denmark's position that Greenland is not for sale. Meantime, Mutte Egede, leader of Greenland, is intent on moving forward with independence. It is now time to take the next step for our country, Egede said in a New Year's address. Like other countries in the world, we must work to remove the obstacles to cooperation, which we can describe as the shackles of the colonial era, and move on, unquote. He has said that an independent Greenland would have close relations with the United States as well as with Europe. But that promise doesn't seem to satisfy Trump. Finally, back to Donald Trump. His choice for Commerce Secretary is tied to cryptocurrency. Howard Lutnick, chairman and CEO of the Wall Street investment bank Cantor Fitzgerald, and Donald Trump's nominee to be the next Secretary of Commerce, has his hands deep into the cryptocurrency netherworld. Cantor Fitzgerald is a banker for the most widely used stablecoin in the world, Tether, the most traded cryptocurrency in the world. What most concerns some senators who will question him is the use of stablecoin in secondary markets to finance terrorism, facilitate cybercrime, money laundering, and the sale of precursor chemicals for illicit drug manufacturing. As Commerce Secretary, Lutnick would be responsible for regulating the stablecoin business. Notably, Tether announced plans to move its headquarters to El Salvador on Monday. El Salvador, under an authoritarian leader, Nayib Bukele, has embraced cryptocurrency as a competitive advantage, moving its own economy and currency into crypto. And Bukele was the second leader, after Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman, to be called by Trump after Trump's inauguration. The plot thickens. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I am joined today by Damaris Webb, co-founder of the Vanport Mosaic. We're here to talk about their event coming up on Sunday, February 2nd. It's called All Power to the People, the Legacy of the 10-Point Platform. Welcome to the show, Damaris.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So tell me about the event that's coming up this weekend, All Power to the People. What can folks expect?
Well, this weekend's event at the historic Alberta House is an opportunity for us to support Mr. Kent Ford, who, if people are not familiar, is a activist here in Portland who's, he's past his 80-year mark now, and he's been fighting for the people for the past 50 years in the streets and always out the box. He was a co-founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party, but is still very engaged in supporting people and organizations who are part of the resistance and making sure that mutual aid is still encouraged and expanded for all peoples. And this weekend, Mr. Ford will treat us to a narrated slideshow from his personal collection, where he talks a little bit about his history here in Portland and the struggle, the history of the struggle here. And then there's a short documentary film that Laura Laforte, the other co-founder of the Vanport Mosaic, a short documentary that she made to him. And then we'll have a panel with invited guests of historians and activists and educators, and just draw out how the legacy of the Black Panther Party nationally, as well as the work that they did here locally, is resonant today, and who's doing work here on the ground. And the point of the 10-point platform that we're focusing on this year is point number 10. And that's the afternoon event. And then in the evening, we have a Indigenous and Black Solidarity Dinner and Story Circle, which is more limited seating, and it's for those who self-identify as Black and Indigenous, that is being led by Michael Stevenson Jr. and Joshua Hood. So that should also be amazing.
Very cool. Well, I want to ask about this panel discussion that's happening in the afternoon. Who's going to be on that panel?
So this year's panel will include Erica Montgomery of Erica Soul Food, Tracy Drake, who is an archivist and is out of Reed College, A.J. McCreary from the Equitable Giving Circle, Reiko Hillier, which is from Lewis and Clark, who is an associate professor of history, and then, of course, Mr. Kent Ford. And there's always a few other people who we might not anticipate who show up. That's what's so exciting about having these group conversations, because also the organizations that are tabling, the people from those organizations, I'm sure will have things to say, as well as the, you know, people who show up to support Mr. Ford. So we're in for a treat.
I'm sure this will be delved into very deeply this weekend, but I'm curious, a little preview from your perspective, what is the importance of the work of the Black Panther Party and the 10-point platform in today's world?
So the point number 10 is kind of, you know, a summary of everything. Point number 10 of the Black Panther Party's 10-point platform is, we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace. And these, you know, desires from the late 60s, you know, these needs for the people are still so resonant in all of those areas today. Their blueprint of the 10-point platform, you know, this question that would keep coming up during Black Lives Matter, well, what do you want? What do you want? Well, here's, you know, a blueprint of it that I think pretty well encompasses the needs of the people, and still is so true today. The survival programs, especially, that have been maybe intentionally suppressed as far as the information of what the Black Panther Party did, especially here in Portland. I don't know if people know that Black Panther Party here had a dental clinic, which was pretty much one of the only chapters that did. And these are free, you know, for the people and by the people. And that a rainbow coalition is what made this happen. So although it is Black empowerment organization, the way that we can ultimately move forward is to work together for common good. I hope I answered what you asked.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and I think there's hardly a wrong answer to that kind of question. But I mean, it is, you know, especially poignant to bring that history up at the moment that we're in right now.
Very much so. I mean, especially with things like Project 2025 and the erasure of DEI initiatives. I mean, you know, where we at least sound like we're heading, we need this coming together in solidarity even more than ever.
And a lot to learn from and take forward.
Indeed. I mean, I think you know, sometimes, I mean, there are specific works that have happened that can be replicated, but I think also just to have a chance to come together and hear stories and consider each individual, like right now, here today, you have some sort of individual sphere of influence and how that can be activated, how you can choose, and that there will be different organizations who are tabling and who are doing the work right now on the ground. You could choose to support them. You could choose to learn more about them and educate yourself. There's so many different ways that we can have traction and have hope during this time, actionable items. And so I hope that everyone who attends has some idea of a way that they can take action and move forward.
Well, this is also the first event in Vanport Mosaic's year-long 10th anniversary celebration. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the organization? And what else can folks look forward to in the coming months?
Well, if you visit our website at vanportmosaic.org, you can find out about tickets for this event on Sunday the 2nd. You can also find out about our next partnership with Oregon Historical Society on the 11th, which is a Tuesday evening, where we will be doing our first public screening of a filmed version of a play that was commissioned about Mr. Kent Ford's life. And that will be an exciting time to be there. Mr. Ford will also have some conversation after that event with Oregon Historical. And then I've developed, along with other collaborators, but educational materials that are free to the public or to other organizations who want to educate themselves further about Mr. Ford's work and that of the Black Panther Party. We also have some pop-up traveling exhibits. And then there is, of course, at the heart of all of the All Power to the People programming, Mr. Ford's walking tours of Albina, which he still gives at 81 years old. So you can check our website to find out more about that. But we have memory activism engagement events throughout the year. One of our largest events is our festival, which will happen in May. And it is indeed the 10th annual festival, and how we started, Laura refers to herself as a story midwife and recovering journalist. And we met, Laura was doing documentary interviews to former residents, to survivors of Vanport, and I happened to be directing a play about the history of Vanport at the same time. And so we started talking and realizing that there were so many other efforts that were being made to keep that story, which is so complex in its own mosaic, right, about the story of Vanport and what it meant, and in tributes that were being done by historians, by archivists, by artists, by educators, right? They look so many different types of ways. And it seems to make sense to hold one festival so that all of this efforts could come together and be in conversation with each other, also be amplified by each other's proximity and a malleable container to hold this mosaic of information. And then to have conversation, community conversation surrounding these efforts. And at the heart of that was a reunion dinner, a private reunion dinner for former residents who we still have some who are with us. We had a lot more 10 years ago in their 80s, 90s, some even in their hundreds. And that was the original plan, was to just do this one festival. And we realized the hunger, the need to have stories told in this way. And here we are 10 years later. We are now, you know, a nonprofit that offers year-round programming. That is my very short story of the Vanport Mosaic. But if you visit our website, vanportmosaic.org, you can learn a little bit more about our year-long programming. We don't set a season. We try to be as responsive as we can to what the needs are on the ground, and we have collaborators from all imagined disciplines, which is exciting for us who might have particular disciplines in a particular subject to be pushed into another way of looking at the same information. And I hope that this way of having multiple entry points into stories from Vanport, Chinatown, Japantown, Albina, etc., can give anyone an entry point into these stories and our local history.
It's a terrific explanation for the record. And of course, congratulations on 10 years.
Thank you.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything else to add before this event coming up on Sunday?
I hope that especially educators who are looking for ways to engage this material are able to attend and take advantage of this large cohort of material that is being offered for them. So that is something I deeply hope that we can keep Mr. Ford's legacy alive and that of the Black Panther Party here in Portland and beyond.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That was Damaris Webb, co-founder of the Vanport Mosaic. We spoke about their event coming up on Sunday, February 2nd. It's called All Power to the People, the Legacy of the 10-Point Platform. It's happening at the historic Alberta House in Portland on Saturday, February 2nd at 2 p.m. The address is 5131 Northeast 23rd Avenue in Portland. More information is online at vanportmosaic.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
Hi, I'm Queen Ida, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on your radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music. Bon ton roulette. Oh, yeah,